This is a presentation from Narara Valley Baptist Church, a church that's desperate for God and passionate for people.
Morning, friends. How's it going? Good. So, I look slightly different from when I have been here in the past. For those who haven't seen me before, for 13 years I had dreadlocks until 1 week ago. 1 week ago, I cut off my 13-year-old dreadlocks, which is quite a scary thing to do. Has anyone had dreadlocks before? None of you, great, good. It's quite a scary thing to do in the sense that, like, it was my identity for 13 years. It was like my poetry brand. It was like everyone knew me as the red-headed dreadlocked poet. Now I'm just the red-headed balding poet. And so I'm trying to kind of work out who I am as this new person. And people are saying new look, new book, which is true. I have also bought out a new book over the last little while, and it's not a poetry book. It's a slightly different book than what I have written in the past. It's a book that I've been actually writing for the last 7 years. I started writing it on an island called the Holy Island of Lindisfarne. Has anyone heard of that island before? A few people. It's an incredible place in the world. I stayed there for 3 months in the middle of winter. It's off the coast of Scotland, so it's like snowing on the island in a 500-year-old house where essentially all you can do on an island in the middle of winter when it's snowing outside and it's a 500-year-old house is sit in front of a fireplace, drink whiskey, and write a book. So that's what I did. I started writing it there, and then I had kids a little while later, and so it took a long time to come to forbear. But it's here now, and it is called Woven: A Faith for the Dissatisfied. I once did a psychology degree at university, and I did a business unit in this psychology degree. I don't know why I just did. And the only thing I remember from this business unit, it was called The Business of Change. It was about how change happens within organizations. And the only thing I remember was the line that change only occurs because of dissatisfaction. Change in an organization only occurs because of dissatisfaction, because people are dissatisfied with how things have been. And we can relate that not just to business, but to our own life. Change occurs in our lives when there's dissatisfaction, when we're dissatisfied with what has been, when something has happened in our lives that causes us to be dissatisfied, that causes us to be like, God, I don't know where you are right now. And I thought you were meant to be here in my life, and I thought you were meant to give me this kind of life. Like, I thought if I grew up as a Christian and did the right things, then I'd get married and I'd have a really good marriage. But I'm single still, God. Or maybe I got married and man, marriage is hard. And then I had kids, and that's just on top of that. Sometimes I can't even breathe. Like, that feeling of dissatisfaction. Has anyone had that feeling at some point in their lives of dissatisfaction? Wonderful if you haven't. Can I swap lives with you? I think most of us go through that feeling of dissatisfaction. And what I want to kind of take us through today is a bit of a metaphoric journey. I'm a poet, so I like to use metaphor to kind of grapple with things and think through things. And I have a metaphor in my book that's kind of split up into four parts, and I want to share three of these parts with you. I've forgotten your name. Josh, of course, Josh. So I'm going to get Josh to play as I share. I want to share these three parts scattered over our time together this morning, just to help us think, to give us an image to think through some of the ideas that I reflect on in my book and some of the ideas I want to reflect on with you guys today. It's called a boat story, these little kind of, it's a bit of a fable. So why don't you close your eyes for a second? They're just small parts, and I want to share and maybe... imagine this. Use your imagination. The boy was given a boat. A wooden boat, a small boat for a small boy. The perfect fit. He could reach the oars and the tiller and the ropes all from where he sat. His father made him the boat, and each day he would look on from the nearby shore, telling his son what to do, how to paddle, how to hoist the sail, how to tie the knots. The boy learnt it all and so began to maneuver around the harbour by himself. Occasionally the wind would pick up and the waves would rock the boat and the boy would be scared, but he knew that the harbour walls would protect him and his dad was near enough to rescue him, so he kept on sailing every day around and around that little harbour. He learned every part of it, memorized the rocks and the sand dunes and where the coral rose up beneath the water, where the rip could take you out of the mouth of the harbour and out to the sea. He knew all the boats tied up at the docks, those old and falling apart that hadn't left the harbour since he was born, those that would go out and not return for days or weeks or months, and those that never came back. The boy wondered what was out there. He'd stare at the horizon beyond the harbour wall and something would swell inside. But his dad would call out and warn him not to stray too near to the mouth of the breakwater. So he would turn back, continue his sailing around and around and around the harbour. You can open your eyes. We all start off in a harbour somewhere. The lives that we have, the lives that we live, we all start in a harbour. We're shown what life is like the little boy was shown by his dad, was shown what the harbour was like, was shown how to sail his boat. All of us start off in a harbour. All of us, I started off sitting around a kitchen table with my father, learning about life, learning about the world, learning about God, being told about the scriptures. I grew up in a Christian church. I went to Bible study and youth group, and I was shown what the harbour was like. I was shown what kind of, how to read the scriptures. I was shown and I was taught about God, and I was baptized in his name, and I was shown God's love, and I was given this harbour to swim around in, to maneuver around in. We all start off in a harbour. We all start off somewhere being shown what life is like and what God is like. I wonder what your harbour was like. Whether you grew up in a Christian family, in a conservative Christian family, whether you grew up in a family that wasn't Christian, whether you grew up in whatever family you grew up in, whether it was a joyful family and a loving family or a cold family, or an angry family, or an abusive family. We all grow up in the harbour of some description. And in this harbour, sometimes we don't quite realise kind of the waters that we are sailing around in. Another of my favourite sayings in the world is, a fish in a bowl doesn't know that it's wet. Has anyone heard that saying before? A fish in a bowl doesn't know that it's wet. In other words, it's been swimming around its little watery environment or sailing around in the harbour all of its life. Sailing around in the harbour of my life, I had no idea what was outside the harbour. We all start having not much of an idea about what lies outside, out of our cultural fish bowls, out of our cultural harbours that we've been sailing around in. And so when I came and read the scriptures, I didn't realise that I was reading the scriptures as a white, middle, upper class, heterosexual, male. These are the lenses by which I viewed the scriptures, by which I read them. And that shaped me in certain ways. Let me read a little part out of my book, a different part that maybe some of you might be able to relate to. We'll see. We'll see. It's on page 51. It's a little bit about my upbringing. This is who we were back then. This is who I was back then. Admittedly, it was a mixture of my church and the pervasive presence of the American evangelical system of the 90s, all packaged through the magazines that I read, the music I listened to, and it all came together to form my cultural Christianity. But what a Christianity it was. We were passionate. We were filled with purpose. We were going to do amazing things for God. This we knew for certain. Our insider culture made us feel different from the rest of the world. Special, chosen. We had God on our side. We were right and they were wrong. Even their music was wrong. So I got rid of all my secular albums during my passionate teenage years. Did anyone else do that? Metallica and Pantera were burnt down by the creek near our house. I wish I didn't do that. But for some reason, I was told that's what I had to do. So instead, as in any fishbowl defined by social artifacts, we listened to our own music. Jars of Clay, Audio Adrenaline. I knew all the words to DC Talk's Jesus Freak. And I still, does anyone else still know the rap from DC Talk's Jesus Freak? Do you want to share it with us? You want to? No? It's something like, I saw a man with a, I saw, how does it start? Wait. Like marmalade jelly, it took me a while to catch what it said, because I had to match the rhythm of his belly with my head. Jesus saves is what it raved in a typical tattoo green. He stood on a box in the middle of a city and he claimed he had a dream. There we go. So, those of you who grew up in the evangelical world in the 90s, you'd know that song. If you were a teenager, it was like the song. It was the song. And I would dance around to it in my room, yelling the words out to the walls, my face covered in passionate tears. I don't really care if they label me a Jesus freak. There ain't no disguising the truth. This was me declaring my allegiance to this Jesus, declaring how I'd follow him with my whole life, even if my school friends didn't understand. I would do it, and I did it. But here was the problem. I didn't realize what I was declaring my allegiance to looked more like the evangelical fishbowl of the 90s than a rebellious Jewish man named Jesus. During my teenage years, a marketing fad took off in the evangelical world, WWJD bands. Who wore one? Put your hand in the air. Who still has one on now? Put your hand in the air. Still have yours on? Oh, wow, that's amazing. That's great, that's great. I heard they were the most stolen things from Christian bookstores during that time, the WWJD bands. It stood for what would Jesus do? The bands were meant as a reminder in any situation, ask yourself the question, what would Jesus do, and act accordingly. It was a nice attempt at a quasi-ethical framework for teenage Christians, aimed at moving them on from choosing action solely based on self-interest. Yet as a Western teenager asking this question, I wasn't in reality seeking to imitate exactly what this Jewish man of 2,000 years ago did. A simplistic repetition of Jesus' life would have meant an adherence to the Jewish traditions of that time. It would have meant not getting married or having children. It would have meant so many things I wasn't actually prepared to do. So rather than imitating Jesus, it was instead an uneducated speculation about what Jesus might do in a current situation. The problem was that the Jesus I was asking this question of looked a whole lot like me. I'm a white man. This white skin is an emblem of my privilege. I didn't know this back then and couldn't have known it, like the fish could not know its wetness. If those around us serve as a mirror to who we should be in this world, all around me, I could see white. My childhood was white. My high school was white. My church was white. My pastors were white. Later in life, my theology college was white. My professors were white. My theology books were white. So inevitably, my Jesus was white. My Bible was white. My God had been white. I've painted the world with this one color for too long. We have painted the world with this one color for too long. This is the Jesus you end up with when you read Jesus solely from the perspective of the privileged. Those with the mansions on the hill, privilege dictates a certain understanding of the world. And so I cannot help but read the Christian scriptures through the lens of being a middle-class white heterosexual man swimming around in his fishbowl, sailing around in my harbor. In my teenage years, I didn't realize that while I may have one answer to what Jesus might do, someone else swimming in a slightly different fishbowl would have another answer. The conservative right-wing evangelical would deduce a different answer from the progressive left-wing Catholic or the Guatemalan mother or the Iraqi father. So not surprising, when I asked what would Jesus do, I ended up with answers that validated all of my own biases. Does that kind of make sense? We sail around in our harbors, we swim around in our fishbowls. But as we do so, when I read the scriptures, I don't read the scriptures from the perspective of my beautiful Indigenous friend, Brooke Prentice. I don't read the scriptures from the perspective of my beautiful friend, Hannah Chapman, a Maori lady in New Zealand. And what they bring to it, the stuff they have taught me, I never knew swimming around in my fishbowl, sailing around in my harbor. My harbor was too small. Our harbors, the fishbowls that we swim around in, what I put to you is they're too small. And what we do is we have our fishbowl and we say, this is the way that it is. This is how you understand God. And if you don't understand God like my fishbowl does, like my harbor does, then you've got it wrong. It's a humbling thing. Humility is something God calls us to all the time. It's a humbling thing to admit one's own arrogance, to believe that I have God nailed, that I have the reading of the right reading of the scriptures, when someone else who is different to me might have a different idea. We can either go our separate ways and say, well, you just believe you're wrong and I'm right. You just go your way, I'll just go my way. That's an individualism that our world upholds. What I put to you today and what lies at the heart of this book is what if we actually began to listen well to each other? That we began to listen well, especially to those people not part of our fishbowls. Because they will show us things about the scriptures that we have never even considered before. The scriptures were written from the perspective of a people group who were oppressed by the Babylon Empire, by the Egyptian Empire, by the Roman Empire. The scriptures were written by a people group living in poverty often, living in starvation. I've never lived in poverty. I've never lived in starvation. So I read them from a different perspective. I have to, I must come and somehow learn to read and engage and listen to the perspective of those who aren't on my side of the coin, who aren't the privileged dominant ones in society. And when I do that, when I have done that in my life, when I've had experiences, like I remember one of my full-on experiences of my life, one of the defining moments of my life, I went over to the border of Thailand and Burma when I was a lot younger. And on the border of Thailand and Burma, I arrived at the same time as this mother arrived. And as this mother arrived there to this orphanage, it was called the Bamboo School, she'd been carrying her sick baby boy on her back for 3 days, trekking through the jungle, trying to find medical attention for her baby boy. Sadly, just like our government says to anyone seeking asylum, no, we don't want you here. The Thailand government was the same. And so you couldn't get any medical attention. You couldn't go in a hospital. You'd be refused treatment. But she heard about this lady, heard about this place to come to where her son could be treated. She arrived and I arrived. And as she arrived, she realized that her baby boy had just died on her back. So my first experience there in the Thailand-Burma border was walking up this little jungle path with two of the orphan boys to this grave site, makeshift grave site amongst the bamboo jungle with bamboo crosses affixed around the place and digging a grave for this baby boy and burying this baby boy. This boy that easily could have been, if the boy had grown up, if it was my kid, we'd just go to the doctors, go to the hospital, would have been fixed, get some medicine. This experience shattered my life. It shattered the fishbowl I'd grown up in. It made me recognize the smallness of my own harbor. It caused a storm in my life, questions. I couldn't stop. I was like, how could there be a God who would let this happen? And why did I grow up so ignorant to this? And why, like my parents, how could you have grown? I point lots of, as we move into a time, it's what I call our unraveled self. If the fishbowl time is kind of a time of being sculpted, it's what I call our sculpted self. We're sculpted by the world that we grow up in, by the things that are taught to us, by family and church. And then when things happen, when the storms of our lives come and the things that were once absolute, when we recognize the smallness of our harbor, it's really easy then to point accusatory fingers back at the kind of the sculpting community that we grew up in and say, oh, you got it wrong. Parents, why did you bring me up in such middle-class values and not tell me about all these poor people living all around the world, that 50% of the world live on less than $2 a day? Why didn't you tell me about this stuff? And God, how could you let this happen? If you were loving like you say, the scripture says you're eternally loving. I cannot see how this could happen if you're eternally loving God. Has anyone been through those times when they've asked those hard questions? Like the, how could you do this, God? Why would you do this? How we go into what I call the unraveled time of life when everything unravels. When we ask the hard questions, when we're not satisfied anymore with just kind of cliche answers, with the things we've been told in the past, and often we fear these times. We're like, we shouldn't ask those questions, or we better not rough up the waters too much. What I want to put to you is actually it's a really crucial time. It's what many kind of faith theorists call the searching time of our lives. When we're searching and questioning and asking the hard things, when dissatisfaction happens. And remember, change only occurs where dissatisfaction is. If we want to change, if we want to grow, if we want to keep growing, we actually have to lean into the questions, to those niggling aches and pains, to the dissatisfaction and say, not ignore them, but lean into them. Here's the next part of that little fable. The boy was given a boat. You can close your eyes again. The boy was given a boat, a wooden boat, a small boat for a small boy. The problem was that the harbor now felt too small. Everywhere he looked was the same as it had always been. He felt restless. So every day he would creep closer and closer to the mouth of the harbor, feeling the pull of the open ocean. Every day his father would call him back to the shore, back to safety. That is, until one day, a day like any other day, the boy got closer to the mouth of the harbor than he had been before. He looked over to see his father momentarily distracted. The boy turned his little boat to face the open ocean and he sailed right out of that harbor. A fire burned in his chest and the wind blew through his hair, salt on his lips. There was a freedom he'd never known. He was alive and it was wonderful. He told himself he would go out just a little way, just a little further and then turn back in. But as the great unfamiliar surrounded him, he decided to go a bit further on just to see what he could see. A little further, a little further. The wind was pushing him in the perfect direction. A dolphin slid up beside him. His little boat soared out of the water. He followed, mesmerized, till the dolphin dipped down out of view and disappeared. And the boy looked around. He realized he couldn't see the harbor anymore. He couldn't see land anymore. He could see nothing but blue ocean. Panic gripped him. He pulled down the sail to stop being taken out any further. He turned the boat around and began to paddle straight back against the breeze. But by now it had really started to pick up. His paddling was getting him nowhere. Within minutes he was exhausted. Still he kept trying. Nothing. He wasn't even sure he was heading in the right direction. And the wind came wilder and wilder still, and so did the ocean. And the little boy was not built for this weather. Soon he was being tossed around by the waves. He would rush down one side, climb a green mountain of water on the other, lobbed from one mountain to another. Giants on the peaks, giants in the sea. The rain fell, the wind howled, and the boy could only hold on for dear life. A wave rose up before him. This time he knew the little boat would not reach the top. He took a deep lungful of air, held his breath, and then the wave came at him. You can open your eyes again. There's this moment when the harbor's too small and the fishbowl gets smashed by the reality of the world like it did in my own life, when I had to turn and face that fishbowl and go, oh, I've been living really small. And as that happens, as I read the scriptures, I remember there was this moment where I, around the same time where I went to a drop-in center for street workers, for prostitutes to come in off the street. A friend invited me along, and I'd never been to one of these things before. It was about the same time, and I had dinner with one of the ladies, and they'd come in to have a meal and have a shower and get washed up before they go out on the street again. And I remember washing dishes with one of them afterwards. They're sitting there washing dishes and thinking to myself, you know, this is the first time that I've spent any time with the people that Jesus spent all of his time with. And I've called myself a Christian, a Christ follower all of my life, yet I've never spent time with the people that Jesus spent all of his time with. And that moment on that day, I said, I'm not a Christian. I'm not a Christ follower. I say the right things. I go to church. I do the Bible. I do the praying. But if I was a Christ follower, I'd do what Christ did. There's a guy named Donald Miller who says that what we say we believe is not what we believe. What we do is what we believe. How we spend our money and how we spend our time, how we spend our energy, that's what we actually believe. And me, I believed in the Western dream. Another guy named Robert Weber says most Western Christianity is just the Western dream with a thin overlay of Jesus. So I had these experiences where I had to confront and be challenged by the smallness of my harbor, the smallness of my fishbowl. And the storm came and the storm hit, and I got angry and frustrated, and I asked the hard questions, and I felt like my life was over. Like for many of you, when the storm has hit, in whatever way it might be, maybe it was an experience like I had, but maybe it was like I was saying before, maybe you thought you were going to end up with a partner and you're not. Maybe it was an experience where a loved one dies, or this didn't happen, or that happened, and the storm comes and life happens and everything unravels. And we want to run from those experiences, but I encourage you again, this is actually when we could lean into the questions. Because you know what? God is there in those moments, in those difficult moments. That's where God actually meets us, out on the open ocean, where there is a sense of freedom and there is also danger, where there is all this stuff that happens, where we move into this unraveled self. We don't do well with the unraveled self times in church. We kind of, when people are going through them, we want to give them cliche answers. We want to say, no, this is the way that it is. You need to believe this. You need to do this. I wonder if going through the unraveled, going through the searching is the only way to come to our own sense of faith. So that the faith we believe in isn't just the faith we had that was sculpted from our parents and from our family. What if we need to go through these times to open our eyes? What if they're a necessary part of the journey, of the movement forward? To open our eyes to what to all that God is, not the smallness of what we thought God was. God meets us in the middle of the storm. And you know what he says? You are okay. You are going to be okay. For anyone who's sitting there feeling that unraveled sense, feeling like you're in the storm, asking those questions and having those questions that sometimes you don't even know if you should ask, God sits there with you in that boat in the middle of the storm and says, you are okay. It's okay for you to doubt. It's okay for you to wrestle. It's okay for you to not even believe that I'm around. It's okay for you to be where you're at. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be here. I'm going to stay with you. We're going to hit these massive waves together. It's okay for you to feel like you can't hold on sometimes because I'm holding on to you. And so I would encourage you to ask the questions. Lean into the pain and the darkness, into the dark night of the soul, into the storm. Don't run from these moments and just kind of shore up your security. God wants us to come open-handed and surrendered, to be like, I don't get it, God. I don't understand you. I don't understand the Bible sometimes. I get frustrated at the church sometimes. I get frustrated at our society sometimes. I don't get it. That's the best posture we can have. Because when we're like, no, I get it. I understand. This is the way that it is. This is the way. Then we stop growing. God calls us to grow. And as we grow, you know what begins to happen? We begin to not have to point those accusatory fingers back at our nurturing community. We don't have to point the church that I grew up in, that I see so many faults with these days. I don't have to get angry at them anymore. As I was unraveling and the storm was happening, I don't have to get angry at them anymore because I realized that they taught me such beautiful things. And my family taught me such beautiful things. And yes, there is a wide open ocean that I have discovered now, but I know as much from them, a beautiful amount of things. And so I need to listen to the old and to the new. Let me read the last part of the fable for you. Close your eyes. Close your eyes and we'll do this last part of the fable. See, the boy was given a boat, a wooden boat, a small boat for a small boy, and the storm had landed, and the boy had held on to that boat till he could do so no longer. From the mast of the boat, he tied a rope around his waist, and he let the boat hold on to him. He thought he would drown. He was just about to give up all hope. Without him even realizing, the storm began to let up. Didn't happen all at once, but at some point the boy noticed the waves were not so mountainous anymore and the wind was not so wild, little by little at ease, till he sat there shivering, crying, tied to a broken boat. He wished his dad was there to find him. The wooden boat was beaten, battered, shredded, surely beyond repair, yet somehow still afloat. The boy looked down to see that water was leaking inside fast. One of the planks had been torn away by the waves, so the boy did the only thing he could think of. He pulled off a loose piece of wood from what had been the railing of the boat and he snapped it in half, and it was just the right size. He jammed it tight into the hole and the water slowed to a trickle. He inspected the rest of the boat. The sail was torn, dangling limp and useless, the rudder gone, more holes in the hull, more water leaking in, ropes snapped, the mast broken in two, one oar was gone. The boat was a disaster, unsailable, highly sinkable. At any moment, it felt like something would give and would all just fall apart. Way out there in the ocean, there was nowhere he could dock his boat and repair, but he knew he had to fix it somehow, or it'd all be over. He was lost and alone, and everything he knew was gone, just a small boat on the wide expanse of an unfamiliar sea. And then he heard a noise, something over the edge, bumping against the boat. He looked over the side and saw a piece of driftwood. He picked it up. A little further on, he saw another, this time larger, a wooden plank. was the perfect size for a makeshift oar, so now he had a pair of them. He looked over the edge again and saw around him many floating things. The flotsam and jetsam of the boats and shipwrecks and rubbish dumped out at sea. The storm must have swept it all into the same currents as he. So he found some more wood to use as a rudder, more rope to tie his boat back together, fishing line to thread the sail. He prized out useless parts of his boat and reworked them into things he needed. The seat he tore off to make a mast. One more loose railing became a boom for the sail. He used the salvageable pieces of his broken boat and the scraps floating past, and slowly, piece by piece, his boat was mended, remade, reconstructed from the old things of the boat as well as from the new things. It didn't look like it once did, but it would keep afloat. It was enough to catch the wind again, to ride the waves once more. The boy didn't know which direction was home. He didn't know if he could ever find home again, but as he turned to look around him, a gust of wind blew into the sail and the boy breathed it deep into his lungs. There was something in the wind that smelled of hope. So he let it fill him. He placed his hand on the tiller and he set sail. You know, my faith these days doesn't look heaps like my parents' faith. It does in many ways, but it looks different. And you know what? That's so wonderful. That's so okay. And I've been able to take the pieces of the old boat that my dad built for me. And I've been able to find where it was leaking because of the storms of my life. And I've been able to take pieces from here and use pieces of the old. And I remember the grace that my church taught me about. And I remember the love of scriptures that my church taught me about. And by the pieces of the old, as well as pieces of the new, the flotsam and, isn't that the best words in like the English language? Flotsam and jetsam. It's so good. The flotsam and jetsam of these new things, of new people that I get to talk to, of my Indigenous brothers and sisters, of my Iraqi friend that I met the other day on the plane that I got to talk to for 14 hours because we were stuck together on a plane, and learn about how Middle Eastern people experience God and understand Jesus and understand the scriptures. These new things that float past, by the new and the old, we were able to reconstruct our ship. Does that make sense? Does that metaphor work for you? Do you kind of get what I'm talking about? A little bit. And by this reconstructed ship, I am able to handle the weathers, the storm of life, the things that happen in our life. This is the movement of what I talk about in this book, from the sculpted self to the unraveled self, where everything unravels, to then beginning to find a woven self. The book is called Woven, to find how these unraveled threads could weave back together. And in the complexities and in the grayness, life is not so black and white, I realize, anymore. But in the hardships of life, in the questions of life, in the struggles and the wrestles that we have, these threads are being woven back together. And I find God in that place again and again and again. God comes to me, as Paula D'Arcy says, God comes to us disguised as our lives. Let's not miss God because we're so desiring for our faith to look like this that we don't realize God is meeting us in the 4:30 a.m. morning. Sorry, Will Small. God is meeting us in the vomit and poo of being a parent. Talk a lot more about vomit and poo than I ever used to. God is meeting us in the mundane realities. And we're so busy thinking the grass is greener on the other side. But God meets us here in the mundane, in the broken, in the struggles, in the wrestles. And he once again says, you are okay. You are okay. That's what this book is about. What our lives, I think, are about. Dissatisfaction brought on by all the things that happen that causes us to change. And the book asks the question, how do we do that healthily and well? How do we not throw the baby of faith out with the bathwater of the cultural Christianity we grew up in? I'm going to get you guys to do some writing now, just for a bit. Does that sound fun? Pull out your phones. If you have a phone. If you don't have a phone, we didn't think about getting paper and pen for people who don't have a phone, did we today? I forgot about that. If you don't have a phone, you can mull over this, but if you do have a phone, you must get it out to write on. I want to give you a moment and I want to ask you a question, and I just want you to answer the question. You just heard a fable from me, a metaphor about life. I want to ask you a question. I'm going to get you to write some words as a reflection for you as to where you're at. Once we've done this, I'll just perform one, I'll share one poem for us and we'll finish up. My question is this, we'll go for a metaphor again. If your faith, where you're at right now, I want you to be as honest as you can. I don't know what that was. If your faith was a landscape, a setting, a place. Landscapes are mountains and deserts and cities and oceans and valleys and alleys and churches and theaters and cathedral. If your faith was a landscape, what kind of landscape would it be? So I want you to write, I am. And then I'm going to give you just like 3-4 minutes and you're going to do what we call flow of conscious writing. Flow of conscious writing is where you put pen to paper or thumb to screen and you're not allowed to stop writing. As in, you can't think about what you're going to write. You just write whatever wants to come out. It helps us get out of our editing brain for us poets and just to write because we get stuck in our editing brain too easily. So you're just going to let whatever wants to come out, come out. I am. If you were, just describe that landscape for me. That's what I'm asking. Who are you in this landscape? I am. What if you were a landscape, who would you be? Are you ready? I'm going to time. Ready? Here we go. I am. And go. Start writing. Go with the first kind of idea that comes to your head about who you would be as a landscape, your faith. Run with that metaphor, run with that image, just see what comes out. People who don't have a phone, don't go off to sleep. Picture the image in your head. Step into the image in your head. Use your imagination for a while. You're halfway through, keep going. As you do this second half, I also want you to ask the question, where is God in this landscape? Bring God into this landscape somewhere. How does God appear in this landscape for you? And what I want to do is just give you just a few minutes quickly now, because it's really easy to pass this over and not own what you just wrote. I'd love you if you can. You can pass if you want, but I'd love you to turn to someone next to you, and if you could read them your piece. This is about being honest. This is about being community together. This is about going, we all go through storms and life. Sometimes it's hard. You may have no idea what the person sitting next to you is going through. Could you share your little piece of writing that you just did with them? You can pass if you want, as I said, it's totally fine, but see if you can have a chat with the person next to you and share it with them. Go for it, just a few minutes to do that. All right. Was that a helpful thing? Was that all right? Good, I'm glad. Look at you poets, yes, a room full of poets, I love it. So what I'd love to do is we're gonna finish with a poem that will go into a song and we'll invite you to sing that final song together with us. If you're interested, I've got these new books are out here. If you're someone who's like, yep, I know that dissatisfaction. And the book is all about how to kind of journey through these storms, these stormy times well. Or if you know someone who is like, you know, has kind of thrown the baby of faith out and you're like, I would love for them to know that they're okay with where they're at and to help them move them forward. And then come and you can buy one of those. It's Christmas soon. You can buy a copy for them for Christmas. Enough plugging my book. Come and get it if you're interested. I'll be out there selling them. But I want to finish with a poem that is about me wrestling through this stuff and trying kind of where I was at and seeing my faith become larger and God calling us into what the kingdom looks like in this earth. And it's a poem called Once. Can we thank my brother for playing for us all the way through this? There was once a little seed planted. Once a little dream started. Once a little fire burning. Once the yearning. Once the gathering. Once the falling in love with a new way of being. Once, this was easier than it is right now. It was a Sunday morning soaring. It was the glory of presence and the story of a saving grace. The race had just begun. Feet run to the new sound. The bound of leaping free. Shackles loosed. The blind to see. It was all these things. It was all these things. Till life got in the way. Till the dark night of the clay. Till God no longer met these expectations and the temptation was to bail, not the water, but my life. My faith is old and tired. It's required so much. How many times, God? How many steps? How many stumbles? How many waves to pound against me? I just want to be free. But he looks at me. Straight in the eyes, he's staring and I'm glaring into him. He looks at us. And ask us to trust in the rush of life and in the fight. When all has fallen, faith only begins when we're tempted to throw it all in. Faith is only faith in the midst of doubt. So he asks us to hold on to that little seed planted, to the little dream started, to the little fire burning, to the yearning, to the calling, to the gathering, to the falling in love with a new way of being where faith it's not about a Sunday morning, but about drawing a line in the sand and walking forth head high, feet stumbling though they may be. The broken that we are in the midst of a broken world, we give ourselves to the suffering of humanity. For there was once a man who suffered that we wouldn't have to be we black or white or rich or poor, at home or seeking asylum. Our call is to never walk past them. The Christ came to bring his new kingdom, not the Western dream nor comfortability. Not pie in the sky, but flesh and blood and loaves of bread for the hungry, a cup of water for the beggar, to visit the prisoner and the refugee. You see, what we believe is not seen in the things that we say, nor even the way that we pray, but in the way that we live, in the way that we give ourselves to those who have nothing. I am seeing that it all begins here. Not when I got it all together, but when we're holding on, no matter the weather, the cost or the loss, we take up our cross. He's calling us in. So I stand declaring, I shall give of myself and my wealth and all that I am. I shall give of myself and my wealth and all that I am to that little seed planted, to the little dream started, to the little fire burning, to the yearning, to the calling, to the gathering, to the falling in love with a new way of being. This is he who looks at us now and says, come. Come follow me. This will not be easy. It was never meant to be. Still, he says, come. Come into this. Lean into this. Lean into the darkness, for that is where I shall meet you. He says, come. And I look my Savior in the eyes and I say, but I'm frightened. I don't understand it all. I don't get it all. I look my Savior in the eyes and I say, I'm frightened. But I will follow. I will follow. Today I choose to follow. Come hell or high water, come storms, come broken boat, come the freedom of the ocean and the danger of the ocean, come dissatisfaction. I say I will follow.
I will follow your way, Yahweh. We will follow.
This has been a presentation from Narara Valley Baptist Church, a church that's desperate for God and passionate for people. To continue the conversation, we invite you to join us Sundays at 9:30 a.m. and 5 p.m. or on our website at www.nvbc.info.